Opposing government corruption, defending our suspended constitution, demanding the rights of we the people, broadcasting the truth, the puppet media dare not report. Long live liberty and death to the new world order. Prepare yourself. This is the alternative media.
And we are back for another hour of the alternative media. I'm Patrick Slattery, and I'm here with attorney Don Advo. And we've been talking about the election, in particular, the electoral process. And we were talking about, just before the top of the hour, we were talking about the possibility of neocons deserting Trump. And rather than splitting the Republican Party, you know, William Kristol had originally talked about launching a third party candidate or, you know, alternative Republican, getting a mainstream Republican. But others like Robert Kagan are just have already said, well, heck, let's just line up behind Hillary. And why not? I mean, if they're not social conservatives, if all they want is, you know, war and Wall Street, Hillary, why? What's wrong with Hillary? You know, that's what she's all about. And then, you know, the corresponding phenomenon is that a lot of Sanders supporters are increasingly becoming having animosity towards Hillary because, well, their debate. If you saw the debate last week on CNN, they had a pretty cantankerous debate, and you know, a lot of Sanders supporters support Sanders because they think he's good on, you know, he's peaceful. He's not going to be having all these wars for Israel, which is debatable, but that's their impression. They don't think he's going to, they think he's a good peace candidate and he's anti-Wall Street. And, you know, even his anti-Wall Street credentials are not what one might think when you get down to it. He's, you know, worked with Ron Paul to on a audit the Fed bill, but of course Ron Paul's bill was originally end the Fed. That was his thing, and to the extent that they worked together on an audit the Fed bill, Bernie Sanders kind of watered it down some. But still, that's the impression. The impression is he's anti-war and anti-Wall Street, and a lot of Sanders supporters are starting to say publicly that they would not vote for Hillary. And Susan Sarandon, the Hollywood actress, she said, you know, very frankly, that she would rather Donald Trump be president than Hillary. So what do you think, Donna? Is there some sort of possibility of some sort of, you know, not necessarily an alliance, but some coming together of Sanders supporters and Trump supporters after the conventions, and, you know, if one or the other of their candidates is frustrated?
Well, I think there's a real possibility that there will be a coming together. I think Sanders supporters, I think there is a good possibility Sanders supporters will switch and vote for Trump in a way that I don't think Democrats would ever have switched and voted for a Republican nominee in the past, such as Barry Goldwater, although a lot of Democrats voted for Ronald Reagan. But there's no way they would ever have switched for Barry Goldwater, and probably not for George W. Bush. I don't think he got much of it. I think there is enough anger and enough disenchantment with the two-party scam that people are ready to take on the leadership of both political parties. I'm looking at Breitbart now, and there's a headline that says exclusive leading progressive activist considers potential emergence of third party right-left populist coalition. A lot of people are thinking the same thing, apparently. I haven't read the article yet. It just now kind of popped up. So, yeah, I think there's a chance that Sanders people will switch over. I don't see many Republicans switching over to vote for Sanders, though. But who knows?
Yeah. Well,
you know, I see a lot of Trump supporters not voting, including myself. If Trump is not the nominee, I'm not going to vote. What's the point? There's just no point to it. There's no point. I mean, Kasich, you're gonna vote for Kasich. You're gonna vote for, you know, Ted Cruz, who is really just despicable. You know, I'm not sure I'm gonna gonna vote if Trump is not the nominee.
Right. Well, I voted third party in almost all of my elections, and I think I regret it every time I didn't. The whole lesser of the two evil is not much fun, but Trump's somebody that, you know, for the first time I feel like I might be able to vote for somebody who might win, and then I hopefully won't feel ashamed of myself later on. you never know with Trump, but Trump, I think, is a tremendous opportunity. He's a risk. You don't know what he's going to be like. But what's he a risk of? He's a risk of a disappointment. That seems to be the main risk. Compared to the alternatives, is he a risk? I mean, you know, compared to Hillary or Cruz, I don't see how he could do anything that would be worse than them. But he's a tremendous opportunity because he's so unique among any presidential candidates we've had in such a long time because he's not beholden to money. I mean, you could look back on Ross Perot, and maybe Ross Perot held out a certain potential. But Ross Perot, yeah, he could be independent from the money donors, but he wasn't really – I mean, he was just talking about things that he thought was common sense or but he wasn't breaking any taboos. He wasn't challenging political correctness. So he wasn't really offering a genuine turnaround or a genuine change. We can take some callers. If you would like to weigh in or ask some questions about this, the number is 1-800-313-9443. That's 1-800-313-9443. Oh, we'll be talking about this for a little bit longer. We're going to get on to some other subjects, but while we're still on the subject, so I think Trump is just a tremendous opportunity. We were talking before the show about, while Jewish billionaires are willing to use their fortune on, you know, political elections or to form organizations to advance their tribal interests, the non-Jewish, the goyim, aren't. I mean, if they're going to spend their fortunes, they're going to spend their fortune on, like Bill Gates, on vaccines for Africa and computers for ghetto kids, which is, you know, that's admirable, but it's not going to get us out of our huge demographic problem. It's not going to get us out of our huge war problem. What do you think, Don?
Well, I think you're right. The goyim have been reluctant to spend their money to fight, but they haven't had much luck in fighting. Henry Ford was slapped down. Joseph P. Kennedy was muzzled and gagged. Charles Lindbergh was kind of shot to the side. Mel Gibson, he's out of business. He's out of the industry, out of the Hollywood industry. So it's hard. It's hard to stand up to Jewish power since they so often crush people almost more often than not.
You mentioned Joseph P. Kennedy, who's the father of John F. Kennedy.
Correct.
I don't know a whole lot about him. I mean, he did make money in Hollywood representing Jewish producers. But what was it about him? How was he slapped down?
Well, Joseph P. Kennedy, I think he was the first head of the Securities Exchange Commission, and Roosevelt later made him he was the ambassador to Great Britain, an Irishman, and it's been speculated that that was Roosevelt's way of sticking it to the British upper classes, to send an Irishman as the ambassador. But he was very, very strongly anti-war. He wanted the United States to stay out of war, and he was very afraid he would be assassinated. He referred to Roosevelt's foreign policy as a quote-unquote Jewish production.
Wow.
Now, His oldest son, Joseph Jr., was, of course, killed in World War II. He died in a kind of a freak plane crash. His plane took off and blew up, and so he didn't even really get much off the ground. He speculated that his son was murdered by Winston Churchill and Roosevelt.
Wow.
To send him a message to shut up. He was pulled out of his position as ambassador, or he resigned, I forget which, but he wanted to become active in anti-war activism, and of course Pearl Harbor changed all that. You really couldn't oppose, you could not successfully oppose the war. The Japanese, killed any anti-war movement in this country. They did themselves far more harm by attacking than they could have done if they had, if they had supported the anti-war effort, they would have been a lot better off. But, he never really recovered from the attack. He's attacked as an anti-Semite and a bigot and a hater and a fascist and all these kinds of things. But not sufficient. But his son was, John F. Kennedy was able to run for office. And of course there was all the speculation, the conjecture, the research that would indicate that the Jewish state of Israel was one of the moving forces in getting rid of Kennedy, because he came down very hard on the Israeli nuclear weapons program. Of course, assuming the White House, Johnson completely reversed the policies on that and greased the skids for Israel to have an atomic arsenal. But he did, he never fully recovered, from the Jewish attacks on him. He turned on Jewish power and it turned on him. As it turned on John Connolly and William Colby and John Paisley and a number of other people.
John Connolly, John Connolly was the former governor of Texas, the former secretary of treasury. He was in the car with Kennedy when Kennedy was assassinated. And he would have been Nixon's choice for vice president, except he had been recently involved in some, legal problems, and so when Agnew resigned, he picked Ford instead. What is it with John Connolly? What are you referring to with John Connolly?
Well, John Connolly was very critical of our aid and our blanket unqualified endorsement of the Jewish state of Israel. He was very, very critical of that. And that was the source of his legal problems with some phony, trumped-up bribery charge. And a lot of things that got him to be discredited. Michael Collins Piper talked about Connolly in his book Final Judgment. And Piper indicated that there were radical Jews who openly advocated murdering John Connolly. Connolly stood up to challenge Jewish power. And that was pretty William Colby, the former head of the Central Intelligence Agency. Can you hear me now?
Nixon. Yeah, I can now. He was under Nixon, wasn't he?
I believe he was. And he was going to do some. He had resigned and retired from the government. He was going to work for some Arab states and help them in their political, lobby for them with the United States government and lobby for a more evenly balanced Middle East policy. Mm-hmm. And then he was found floating in, I think, Chesapeake Bay. A so-called boating accident. John Paisley was a member of the Central Intelligence Agency staff, and he was very critical of our support of Israel. And he committed suicide by some weird method. He shot himself in the head, and then he hung himself from a tree or something, or jumped in a river. It was one of these weird suicides that, like a Lyndon Johnson. One of Lyndon Johnson's nemeses in Texas was an investigator who supposedly committed suicide by shooting himself 5 times with a bolt-action rifle. And in the post-mortem, he had high levels of carbon monoxide in his bloodstream.
I shouldn't laugh, but, I mean, yeah, shooting yourself 5 times to commit suicide, that's something.
With a bolt-action rifle, you have to work the action manually after each shot. Plus, it's a rifle. And it's easy to point a handgun at yourself, but a rifle, if the barrel's very long, I mean, how do you reach, you have to turn the thing around and you have to be able to reach out to the trigger, which is at the far end of the rifle. I always wondered about that, how did this guy do that? But, in any event, people who ran afoul of Jewish power since World War, or even before World War II, even into the 20s and 30s when they took down Henry Ford, They have not done well. Jewish power is a basic ordering principle of the American political and cultural scene.
Sure is, but we're not allowed to talk about it, so we're not allowed to talk about that. We have a caller, Jeff in Idaho. Jeff, are you there?
Yeah, Patrick. Can you hear me?
Yes. What's on your mind, Jeff?
Hey, Don. Okay, Don, here. This is from an FEC chairman. He was chairman 2 or 3 years, I think. Member 8 years. We spent about $15,000 to $18,000 in 2008 for Ron Paul information. It says, fact, according to the lawyer consulted for this project, there is no federal law or regulation requiring delegates to the Republican National Convention to vote as bound by their state parties. Delegates can unbind themselves and have throughout history. The simplest way is to abstain from voting the number of rounds it takes in your state to become unbound. But in fact, delegates don't even have to do that. So this is what the 13th steel of in Colorado is for Cruz. So they already know that this is known from 2008. This is when we did this for Ron Paul, and in 2012 when we got him 5 states, and then they changed the rules that morning, you know, with Rule 40B, and that's what mm-hmm. they'll be doing. So the thing I would do is they already know this is the game plan going into Ohio right now. All right, so it's theft, 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 and what they're going to do is they're going to basically ruin the Republican Party, and they don't care. And the reason why they don't care is Israel's negotiating right now with the Obama administration for their 10-year funding, because they don't want mm-hmm. Donald Trump to get in and pull their funding. All right, mm-hmm. so all these the neocons are pulling out all the stops against Donald Trump because they're worried about him like messing up the UN and all these other things as he basically tears down what they've built up, you know, basically since World War II. Like, you know, dismantle parts of the UN and stuff. So mm-hmm. what I would do is I would attack Cruz directly by suing the FEC for not vetting Cruz to be on the ballot. You understand what I'm saying? The FEC and the Republican Party are the ones that allow him to put his name to run for president. So the FEC can be sued and say, he's a Canadian citizen, he's not natural born. That's what I would do in the next couple of months. And then watch the neocons' heads explode. Because, you know, once Cruz is gone, and then Kasich's sexual behavior, and is signing off on all the stuff during the Bush administration, you know.
Does Kasich have stuff in his past?
Well, yeah, in his current past. He's got the Velvet Glove Mafia problem. Right. Huh. Like Larry Craig.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, I'm not familiar with that. That's you said Larry Craig.
He's going to have some sexual liaisons that will not work well in the Ohio nominating committee, right?
And you're talking about Kasich or
Kasich
or Cruz?
Kasich, really? Kasich.
Okay.
But Cruz, yeah. So those two are walking, you know, they're walking dead men as far as getting to the nomination. Once the delegates find out what's going on, so they're going to buy. They're going to buy the delegates at $50,000 a head, probably. And that's like the Jeb Bush crowd. That's why he basically suspended his campaign. So this is going to be the most ugly. 1968 is not even going to compare. Because now what's going to happen is you're going to have like 500,000 people maybe circling the, you know, the area, 10,000 police, and then the Republican Party destroying itself. And, you know, it's going to be so split up that you won't be able to elect anyone. And Hillary, Kagan was saying, well, we'd like Hillary. Well, the option
right.
was.
But, hey, Jeff, can you hold on for a second? We're going to break right now, but I'd like you to finish up after the break. Is that okay? All right, so we'll be back after the break with more of the alternative media. Welcome back to the alternative media with Patrick Slattery and Don Advo. And Jeff in Idaho, you still on the line? Okay, well, we had a great call from Jeff. He had a lot of information. Oh, you're still there. Great.
Yeah. Here's the situation.
Yeah, please.
Hillary is not going to be indicted, and people are going to be so upset about that. So originally Donald Trump was brought in to make the clown car crash. They didn't anticipate Donald would outlast everyone else, And now the only one left standing is Kasich, who has a gay relationship that is not going to fit in well. Jennifer, Madam Palfrey, that got hung herself, you know, is maybe tied up with, like, some of the things with Ted Cruz. And Ted Cruz is maybe not as straight as he talks usually. So you've got two bad choices. And so what you're going to see is the reason why they're pushing the Colorado thing right now is they're going to make it where they make a direct vote on the first ballot for someone who's not of those three, I bet you. They're going to try and push Jeb Bush in the first vote. Okay? Mm-hmm. And what they're going to do, because what happens is Donald has the voting support. Kasich has a sexual liaison problem. Cruz is not eligible. And so the last men standing for the neocons are gone. And so now so this is going to be a really strange thing going on, because Hillary's not going to get indicted, and it's going to make everyone, it'll destroy the Republican Party, and then everyone will completely not want to vote, and we'll get a new system. But it's just what's going to come down. I think this is going to be a history-making election right now.
I think so, too. Hey, thanks for your call, Jeff. So Don, what do you think about that?
Well, it's going to be a history-making election, regardless of what happens. I don't know anybody who realistically believes that Hillary Clinton is going to be indicted by a Democrat administration. I doubt a Republican administration would even have the guts to do that. The George W. Bush administration certainly did nothing against her, notwithstanding a lot of things that were still open to prosecution by the statute of limitations. So I think it's going to be very historic. I don't see Jeb Bush coming back in. I know other people say that, and other people think that. I just don't see it. I think that would really, really destroy the Republican Party. Too many people would just not vote, and you know, if the Republican Party is gone, there's a risk that a real second party is going to appear in its place. And maybe that's Trump's historic mission. I don't know how much interest he has in doing anything like that. Probably none.
No,
but they are very, very afraid of an alliance between the white Democrats and the white working class Republicans. They're very, very much afraid of that,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, this, you know, it's hard to look into a crystal ball and see how this is all going to play out, but there you could have a real political realignment. All sorts of things could happen. I want to go into, you know, it is Confederate History Month, and Don, I believe you had some things you wanted to talk about regarding that, but we do have Frank from North Carolina on the line, and I'd like to welcome Frank to the show. How are you doing, Frank?
Hey, I'm pretty good, Patrick, and I'll be real brief. I just, you know, I see this common theme. It seems to be one of the major requirements to be eligible to run for president in recent years, maybe over the past decade, is that you were not born in the United States, or that you have at least one parent that was not an American, and probably the other one was not a patriot. If they were an American, and that just seems to be more and more a common theme. I guess we'll be seeing more and more of that as the years go by. And I'm sure Jeff and Ido probably heard this, but I think I heard it in one alternative media venue and also one drive-by mainstream media that there was a quote-unquote New Jersey judge who ruled that Ted Cruz is eligible to run as president. And that's all I heard on that. I haven't heard a whole lot of details, but so I guess he's good to go. And I think it was some rule that was that they came up with in 1787 or something. But see, that's the thing. They can always make up the rules as they go along. They can just, oh, there's some obscure rule, you know, but they've never mentioned it ever before. But when it comes up, they can just, they have this whole, like, quiver of arrows that they can just pull out. Oh, no, what we did was, it was back in 1687, and we said if we ever had a country, that if this ever happened in the 2000s, that we could just pull this out. And everything would be, I mean, it's just, it's insane. That's all I
have. Okay, well, thanks. So what do you think? Don, you know, I've never really cared that much. Like, with all of Obama's faults, the problem with his birth certificate is just I've never really cared about it. I mean, there's plenty of things to be upset with Obama over. And the same with Ted Cruz. There's so many things to be upset with him over, that, you know, whether he was born in Calgary and things like that. Well, I mean, he was born in Calgary. That's not a debate. But what do you think of, the requirement of a natural born citizen? Do you have a good grip on what that really means?
Well, I thought I did at one time. As the caller has mentioned, so many people have been born outside the country or had parents who were questionable. I'm not sure that I have a good grip on what it means. Okay. I understand the reason for it.
I think we have bumper music that I can't really hear. I don't know if it's one of my great songs. But we do have. I hear it now, and we'll be back after the break.
You're tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Okay, and we are back, the alternative media, with Patrick Slattery and Don Advo. And Don, so just before the break, I was asking you, natural born citizen. What does that mean?
Well, traditionally, it means a person who was born in the United States of America or one of its territories, and a person who was vested with citizenship for that reason. Now, it's as a practical matter, of course, there were people who were the children of active duty military people and diplomatic personnel, such as John McCain. John McCain was born in the Panama Canal Zone.
Was he born in the zone, or was he born on a in a hospital outside the zone? Do you know?
Oh, I think he was born on a military base.
Okay, in the zone. And, of course, then the status of the zone was a little bit, you know. So the zone, was it American territory?
It was American at that time.
Yeah, I mean, it was American administered. Yeah,
the military base was military, but that's how they dealt with that. Very good. Goldwater was born in Arizona when it was a territory, not a state, and people seem to be resigned to that. The thing that's a little troubling to me about the Obama thing is we got a canyon in the White House, and that's for symbolic reasons. That was very destructive of this country. I don't know that he was born in Africa. I doubt it very much. But his birth certificate is most certainly a fraud. The serial numbers on the birth certificate are inconsistent with the date that it was issued. And there was a woman who gave birth in the same hospital the day after Obama's mother. Her name was Eleanor Nordyke. She gave birth to two twin girls. And she came forward with her girls' birth certificates thinking that this would authenticate the Obama birth in the United States. The problem is, the birth certificates for her daughters, which are, look pretty authentic, they were registered with the Department of Health on August 11th. And, the problem is Obama's birth certificate is registered 3 days before that on the 8th, but it has a higher number. And these things are stamped in chronological order as they are submitted to the government entity. So for Obama's to have a higher number when it was filed 3 days before these other two birth certificates indicates it is most certainly a forgery and a counterfeit. Now, I don't know the reason for that. I suspect there's some information about him that on his authentic birth certificate that would be very damaging, but I don't see much evidence that he was actually born in Africa. Would have been very difficult for his mother to make the trip, and his purported father, Obama, the purported, he wasn't really a Kenyan, he was a British subject. Kenya didn't get its independence till after he returned to Kenya. He was a British subject in 1959 when he landed in the United States. Mm-hmm. And I've read his immigration file, which was posted online. There's really no evidence he ever left the United States between arriving here in 1959 and returning. I think he returned in 1963 or 64. He was kicked out of Harvard because he was involved in a lot of hanky-panky, and mm-hmm. they couldn't figure out how many wives he had and a few other problems. But Ted Cruz has a similar kind of a creepy factor. I mean, how is this guy president of the United States? I mean, he really shouldn't be. If you look at the history of his father, a Cuban national, was involved in all kinds of weird intelligence stuff. They think they've got a picture of him standing next to Lee Harvey Oswald in New Orleans, passing out leaflets. So there's all kinds of weird speculation about him. He dodged the draft. He didn't register for the draft in a timely manner. All kinds of weird things about Cruz. There's a
you mean Cruz
family.
When Cruz did not register for the draft, Ted Cruz or his father.
His father Rafael. He became an American citizen, and then he didn't register for the draft until 10 years too late, and he fled to Canada because there was danger that he was going to be drafted or prosecuted for draft evasion or something. So he went to Canada, which is what, during that period, the 60s, which is what a lot of Americans did. Mm-hmm. There's a Bush family connection with Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz worked in the G.W. Bush administration. His wife worked there. I think that's how he met her. And he's not the outsider that he is presented to be. He's basically kind of a Bush proxy. That's my view.
Yeah, I would go along with that. Okay, we have Wes in Idaho. Wes, welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call, Patrick. Wondering if you or Don had heard LBJ actually confess or even brag that they had knocked off JFK in his eulogy to Congress about JFK a week after it actually had occurred. Now, it was said in reverse speech. That's the thing about it. In fact, one of the first things
he
said...
I don't know anything about reverse speech. That doesn't make much sense to me. Do you have any... I mean, that doesn't sound very plausible. Do you have any other kind of information?
Or can I say that it was a 5-hour program with David Oates and mm-hmm. Jim Mars, who is kind of an expert on JFK assassination. It is on the internet for free to look at, to listen to, Jeff Rent. And I'm here to say I've listened to it for years and years, and it always makes perfect sense. Your subconscious does not lie. It is proof that Trump is a straight shooter. A little rough on the edges, yes, but Hillary Clinton and Cruz are liars. It shows up in reverse speech. And
okay. I'll tell you one thing. I sometimes try to spell words backwards, and that's pretty hard. I don't know how I'd pronounce words backwards. If Johnson could do that, he was pretty smart. That's all I can say. Hey, thanks for your call, Wes. You have anything to say about that, Don?
I never heard that before. I have no
idea. I mean, I've heard people talk
about
reverse speech, but it, you know, it's not anything I know about. Yeah.
Don't know a thing about it.
Okay. All right. We're going to be joined at the top of the hour by Professor Richard Sloan from last week. And we're going to be talking about some things. We're going to be talking about the citizenship issues, not just regarding presidents, but in general. So we'll be talking about that. But in the meantime, this is Confederate History Month, and maybe if you could come back on the show another time, we could go into it in a little bit deeper detail. But this is Confederate History Month, and I guess Confederate history is kind of becoming politically incorrect. I guess that's something we're just supposed to forget about. What does Confederate History Month mean to you, Don?
Well, it's a day that's been dedicated by a number of Southern states, I guess, to commemorate the history of the Confederate States of America, which existed very briefly between 1861 and 1865 when the Confederacy was crushed by overwhelming military and economic power of the Union. The Lincoln administration waged a very destructive, bloody, genocidal war against the people of the South. So that's the essence of what it means. I think the history of the Confederacy is not well understood. The history of that whole era, the Lincoln era, and Lincoln himself is not only well understood, it is very, very heavily misrepresented and propagandized. And the propaganda started with Lincoln himself, almost immediately after taking the White House. And the reasons for the war, the justifications for the war, the facts about slavery, and this was not a war to end slavery. It was a war to enslave free men and crush the South and really crush any meaningful opposition to the enormous corporate power that was really born during the Civil War. The military-industrial complex is not so much a creature of the Cold War, but you can really trace its roots all the way back to the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. You know, Sam Dixon, who's an attorney from Atlanta, and he's well known to probably a lot of our listeners, and he was at this Stormfront conference last October, or was it two? Actually, I guess it was 2 years ago, and he gave a talk about the Confederacy, and you know, he's somebody who's a proud Southerner, and somebody sympathetic to the Confederate cause. Yet he was arguing that Jefferson Davis made a blunder by going to war, even in the face of efforts to resupply Fort Sumter or provocations by the Lincoln administration. He thinks that what would have been a better avenue would have been to passively resist, and if Lincoln resupplied the fort at Fort Sumter, and if federal troops came into South Carolina or whatever, that the what would have been a better avenue to pursue, a better strategy, would have just been to resist and not pay taxes, for instance. And the federal budget was so reliant on revenues from the South, from excises and tariffs from the South. And refusing to cooperate with the federal government, this kind of passive resistance would have been a better strategy to pursue. What do you think about that, Don?
Yeah, I think Sam is absolutely correct in that regard. I've studied Jefferson Davis's leadership, and I think he made the same mistake and had the similar flaw that many people do when they're swimming against the tide of history, and they're kind of like victims of their own pathology. The strategy for the South went back many, many decades, and the South foresaw as early as 1820 and probably before that it was going to have to secede. We know this because the diaries of John Quincy Adams, who in 1820 was Secretary of State, reflect a conversation he had with John C. Calhoun, famous United States senator and political thinker from South Carolina, who was at that time, I believe, the Secretary of War. And in 1820, the nation had just emerged from the Missouri Compromise, and this was a heated political change over whether Missouri would come in as a slave state or a free state, and what would be the outcome of the slave controversy. And they kind of drew a line from St. Louis to the West Coast, a horizontal line, and the Missouri Compromise.
36 degrees parallel, as I recall.
Right, right. And they said there could never be slavery above the line, and slavery could only expand in states below the line. And so that bought peace for quite a while. But so vicious was the, so heated was the discussion, that John Quincy Adams' diary reflects a conversation he had with John C. Calhoun in 1820. And Calhoun said, he talked about the South separating from the North. And he said, well, the South will separate. The South will establish an alliance, a diplomatic relationship with the British Empire, and will secure its independence and its sovereignty by using that tactic. Now, Jefferson Davis, 40 years later, I mean, I've read his book, The History of the Confederate States of America, The Rise and Fall of the Confederate States of America. And, he relied very heavily on international law. He relied on recognition by foreign governments such as France and Great Britain. And the French not only didn't recognize the Confederacy, they took advantage of the Civil War to invade Mexico and establish an imperialistic presence there in complete defiance of the Monroe Doctrine, which said the Western Hemisphere was no longer open to colonization or military adventures by European powers. Well, they took advantage of the Civil War to do that. The British deployed a large number of troops to Canada, and they were poised to invade the North in a kind of a pincer motion. And then Russia, the Russian Tsar, got involved and said to the British, well, they deployed the Russian Navy out of the Baltic to such ports as New York City and San Francisco, so they couldn't be bottled up by the British Navy. And the Tsar told the British Empire, if you attack the United States, we will attack you. So there was kind of a quasi-alliance between Tsarist Russia and the Lincoln administration against the British Empire. Europe was eager to see the Confederacy succeed because they wanted to see America broken up. However, you know, the strategy didn't work because by then the anti-slave sentiment had really become very, very strong. And Jefferson Davis could get no recognition from any foreign power. Although the French puppet government in Mexico was desperately trying to achieve recognition of the Union, the Lincoln administration, they even offered the North several northern states.
Trying to get recognition of
Mexico. Yeah, they were trying to get the French government in Mexico recognized by the United States to achieve its
Napoleon
stability.
III.
Yeah, and they said, well, we will give the United States several northern states of Mexico in exchange for diplomatic recognition. To the credit of the Lincoln administration, they refused to do it. The United States stuck by Mexico at a point in time when it had been invaded and was occupied by a foreign power. And I think this needs to be brought out more often, that the United States supported Mexican sovereignty in a way that Mexico has never supported ours. So,
there's a great deal of history people need to know, that's for sure.
The bottom line is Davis's leadership. He was not a very successful war leader. Militarily, he carved up the South into different military districts with commanders who operated independently of each other instead of having a cohesive, unified command. This was very frustrating to Robert E. Lee, who became a senior commander in the Army of Virginia. He made huge, huge mistakes. He was a decent man and a good man, but he really was
when you say here, are you talking about Robert E. Lee or Jefferson Davis?
Huh?
Are you talking about Robert E.
Well, okay, Jefferson Davis was a good man, but he was a very naive man, and he was ill-suited for the task of nation-building and ill-suited for the task of a war of independence. Moreover, Jefferson Davis wanted to expand slavery into the western states. He was a very aggressive supporter of slavery. There were so many currents and countercurrents on the issue of slavery,
and
it's really hard to generalize about it, but he was not a very capable leader, in my view. And Sam Dixon was absolutely right. Sorry. He should not have gone to a shooting war with the Union. Shouldn't have done it.
Okay, we are up on the break now. Yeah, that's break music. Okay, we will be back after the break for a few more minutes, and then again at the top of the hour.
That I've ever seen. Bum, 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 bum. Give him two lips like roses and clover.
Bum, 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 bum.
Then tell him that his lonesome nights are over.
Back. with the alternative media. And just before the break, Don, you mentioned that Jefferson Davis had been a supporter of the spreading slavery to the expansion of slavery to the West. And, you know, this was a big issue. And, you know, slavery is nothing to be made light of. At the same time, we're talking about the Confederacy. The Confederacy did not import any slaves. The Confederacy inherited slaves from a previous era, a bygone era. And, you know, the fact that slaves reproduced in the United States at a rate where they're, you know, you're having this demographic expansion of the slave population that in an era where in other countries the importation of slaves was much more robust because the slaves weren't replacing themselves. That says something about the conditions of slavery. And it's not that we're trying to make light of slavery, but the conditions of slavery in America couldn't have been as harsh as certainly in other parts of the world and in other eras, because slavery's been with us from time immemorial and all over the earth. It does say something that, you know, it's not necessarily politically correct to come out and say that the conditions of slavery in the United States certainly weren't the worst of slavery in the world. They were reproducing, but that's a fact, isn't it?
Well, the fact is that in slavery in the United States, the black population exploded between 1790 and 1865. There were 600,000 blacks in the United States in 1790, and we know this because of the United States, the census. We have very good demographic data on this. With the Constitution, the newly ratified and implemented Constitution, required a census to be done every 10 years so that for purposes of congressional representation and various other things.
It has nothing to do with the three-fifths clause, except the fact that it shows that they were counting slaves.
Well, they were counting the census.
We have the data.
As whole persons.
Yeah, we have the data. I mean, there's no dispute about this demographic expansion.
No, there's no dispute about it at all. None whatsoever. And you have to remember that approximately 11.5 million Africans were transported over the lifetime of the slave trade to the Western Hemisphere. Of those, about 5%, that's about 500,000, were transported to what is now the United States. Now, the United States stopped the slave trade in 1808 pursuant to our Constitution. But even before that, I was kind of surprised to find out, in 1793, there was a very draconian anti-slave trade law passed signed by George Washington. And George Washington signed and implemented some very important anti-slave legislation. One piece was the Northwest Ordinance, which forbade the spread of slavery into what are called the Northwest Territories of Ohio, Indiana, Michigan,
Illinois, Wisconsin.
Yeah. North of the Ohio River and east of the Mississippi. And he stopped the spread of that. And that was an ordinance written by another slave owner, Thomas Jefferson. So Jefferson and Washington were both instrumental in some very, very strong legislative moves against slavery. Moreover, in 1793, the Congress... What, are we out of time?
I think so. Is that the break I'm hearing? It is the break I'm hearing. But we will be back after the hour with Don Adbo and Professor Richard Sloan and myself, Patrick Slattery.